From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Congress is scrambling to find a solution for DACA, the Obama-era program that shields hundreds of thousands of young undocumented immigrants from deportation. Several groups of lawmakers are huddling today to find a legislative fix. One proposal would grant DACA recipients legal status renewable every 3 years, along with $30 billion in funding for a border wall and other things Republicans have long wanted, such as a worker verification program. Republican Representative Bob Goodlatte of Virginia co-sponsors the bill. Welcome.
Glad to be with you.
Well, first of all, let me just ask you about what the president said yesterday about your bill. He didn't exactly take a position on it. He said it's a start. So are you concerned that he hasn't yet thrown his full support behind your bill?
Well, he very much likes our bill, and this is a very serious effort to address what the president has challenged the Congress to do, and that is to do DACA right. And we do that in this legislation, but we also honor the commitment the president made to couple it with securing our borders and ending chain migration.
So, I mean, I take your point that the president said that it's a starting point for negotiations, but it seems as if there are other Republicans who have concerns about the long-term viability of your bill. I mean, I'm seeing that Representative Charlie Dent of Pennsylvania says that the House needs to pass a bill that could get some 300 votes, and he doesn't believe your bill is it because it's too hardline.
There's no bill in the House that could get 300 votes very easily. So we are very happy to negotiate from this bill that I think will have broad-based support within the Republican conference.
And then what about as it might move to the Senate? Because I think that that's the concern, that without adequate support in the House, that it wouldn't survive the Senate.
Well, that's why there are negotiations going on that the president encouraged yesterday. And today I know the leaders in the House and Senate are meeting to discuss the timeline. And I am hopeful that we can make some real progress on solving this problem.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if you already know if there are certain areas that you are willing to negotiate on. And I'm thinking of other examples. There's another proposal out there, bipartisan one, from Texas Republican Will Hurd and California Democrat Pete Aguilar. And their bill would allow qualified DACA recipients a path to a green card and perhaps even eventual citizenship. Is that something you'd be willing to negotiate on in your bill?
Well, I would not be willing to give people who entered the country illegally a special pathway to citizenship that would put them ahead of people who have gone through the long legal process to enter this country legally. It's simply not a fair thing to do. And I think that this status, which not only gives legal certainty to the DACA recipients, but also makes it renewable for indefinite times and therefore a permanent situation, and allows recipients of the DACA program to make use of existing paths to green cards, is a much fairer way to do that.
And Congressman Goodlatte, one last question. I'm thinking about your proposal to end family-based visas or family-based immigration. Some call it chain migration. I mean, just broadly speaking, would you like to reduce the amount of legal immigration overall to the United States?
I would like to see us move to a merit-based system. We are by far the most generous nation in the world for legal immigration. We give roughly 1.1 million green cards out each year. So I think that could be reduced a little, but I also think that a lot of those numbers that are reduced by ending chain migration could be available for a merit-based immigration system, which I would think would be much better, the spouse and the children, the minor children of people who receive green cards to come to the United States should obviously be able to accompany them. However, more extended relationships, adult children, brothers and sisters, are not included in our proposal.
Well, Congressman Bob Goodlatte is a Republican of Virginia and chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. Congressman, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Well, yesterday in that open meeting, President Trump said he was for the Democratic proposal for a standalone bill just on DACA. When Republicans protested, he said he'd wanted a comprehensive bill. Today, he said it must include the wall. Well, one person sure to be at his side as he forges his way is Hope Hicks, the 29-year-old White House communications director who came to his campaign after working with Ivanka Trump on her luxury lines. Michael Wolff, author of the new book Fire and Fury, says she's probably the president's top advisor. And it's also been pointed out she could be the least experienced in modern history. Olivia Nuzzi is Washington correspondent for New York Magazine. Olivia, who is Hope Hicks? Give us a little more.
Well, there is some competition in the Trump White House for the person with the least amount of experience politically. But Hope Hicks is a PR professional who ended up working for the Trump Organization. She's very young. She has no political experience. She is a former child actor and model. And Trump took a liking to her. They became very close. She joined the campaign in its earliest days, months before he announced, went with him to Iowa. And she is now in this White House, the communications director and the longest serving political aide not related to the president by blood. The person who has been with him the closest, the longest amount of time. She traveled everywhere with him. For a long time, she was the only communications staffer on the campaign. She is the person who is the chief gatekeeper to the president of the United States. Her office is right outside of his Oval Office.
Well, and by all accounts, very accomplished. You mentioned her modeling career. There was a short acting career. She was also a star lacrosse player in Greenwich, Connecticut, where her family is very prominent. But her long time with Donald Trump is why people think she might be one of the most interesting people being interviewed in the Russia investigations. What's the thinking there?
Well, look, Hope Hicks has been around the president, as I said, for longer than any other political aide. And for that reason, it's safe to assume that she knows a lot, she has heard a lot, and she has seen a lot. The campaign is really key to all of this. And she was at the campaign from the earliest days, as I said, from months before he announced, from the winter of, I guess, 2015. And so she would, it's safe to assume, have been part of the conversations or overheard conversations or at least been aware of conversations that are things that Robert Mueller, the special counsel, is now looking into.
Well, she publicly issued a denial that there were any contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. That, of course, we know to be a false statement now. There were many contacts. How's that likely to go for her, given that she is being questioned? And by the way, has she been questioned by Mueller?
The New York Times reported that she has already been questioned by Robert Mueller, by the special counsel. Previously, it had been reported that before the end of November of 2017, she will have sat down with him. The Times confirmed that it did happen. You know, Hope Hicks, as you said, she released a statement denying that there was any communication between the Kremlin and the Trump campaign. We now know that that was incorrect. I think what will help her in the end is that by many accounts, I did a profile of her during the campaign for GQ. People described her as being sort of the president's typist in a lot of ways. He would dictate tweets to her. He would dictate official campaign statements. She did not have a lot of autonomy when it came to, you know, what specifically the campaign was saying. Oftentimes she would release a statement that would sound as though it was in President Trump's voice, but her name was attached to it. And so I think that will help her if at any point she does have to explain why she fervently denied that the campaign had any contacts with Russia when we now know that to be false.
Olivia, many of the people that have gone before the Mueller investigation have pled guilty to various things and been indicted. Do we have any sense of how her testimony is going?
Yeah, we really don't. Robert Mueller is not known for leaking to the media, despite what this administration, this White House, might say. We have very limited information about what exactly he has spoken to Hope Hicks or frankly, anyone else about. But the White House has taken this view that cooperation is their best strategy here. We've heard that from Ty Cobb, the president's lawyer, that they are willing to, you know, provide the special counsel with anything that they need. There are some people close to the president, including his personal lawyers, who look at the fact that the special counsel has interviewed very senior White House advisors as evidence that this investigation is coming to a close. Because typically, when you move in closer and closer to the inner circle, that is when things are reaching their conclusion. But it's important to remember that this investigation focuses on the campaign. And so I don't think they're really moving and interviewing people in the same order that they typically do during federal investigations.
When you say she's close to the president, you write her office mm-hmm. is right outside the Oval Office, closer than any other official, so close that from her desk the president can be heard calling for her. But do you agree with Michael Wolff's assessment that she may be his closest advisor right now?
Well, I think geographically, she certainly is the closest, just by virtue of where she is situated most days. And I think that she is closest to him in that she really understands him. The key to why Hope Hicks has survived, while so many others have moved in and out of the campaign and then in and out of this White House, is that she's very good at assessing personalities and characters. And I think that has really helped her understand the president and thus understand how to survive at his side. And so in that sense, I think you could say she's the closest. Look, she's not a political operative. She hadn't worked on campaigns before. I don't know whether or not she's somebody who the president goes for expertise in politics. She comes from a PR family. Her father represented the NFL at one point. He's now at the Glover Park Group. She does have an innate understanding of public relations, and he does trust her very clearly.
Olivia Nuzzi, Washington correspondent for New York Magazine. Olivia, thank you.
Thank you so much.
In some note, Hope Hicks also had a very public shouting match with then-campaign manager Corey Lewandowski on the streets of New York. He was soon fired. Trump reportedly saying to Hicks, "You're here, he's not." About 1 in 10 Americans has some kind of implanted medical device, artificial hips, pacemakers. And if you're like me with my titanium knee, you probably assume they are carefully regulated by the government. But according to our next guest, many are sold without any clinical testing, and less than 1% undergo 2 trials, the standard requirement for drugs. In 2015, 16,000 deaths associated with medical devices were reported to the FDA, but the General Accounting Office estimates that only 1% of device-related deaths are reported overall, because there's no requirement to do so. And then there's regulatory capture, medical device executives sitting on regulatory boards, and doctors who get payments from device companies, and heroic patients like Dennis Fagan. We'll get to him. With investigative journalist Jeannie Lenzer, her new book is The Danger Within Us. She says, of course, millions benefit from devices. But then there's the orthopedic surgeon who, like others, is being poisoned by the cobalt in his artificial hip. Jeannie, start with how companies can blame illness or injury on other causes. So they don't have to report them. It's so-called device or cure as cause.
Yeah, that's right. One of the problems in medicine is that when something goes wrong, doctors tend to blame the underlying condition or disease that the patient has. And when patients get better, they invariably attribute their improvement to the drug or device that they gave the patient.
And in fact, you point to lidocaine, which was supposed to reduce deadly heart rhythms, but people getting it were more likely to die.
Yes, and it was really an important illusion because these bad rhythms that are likely to kill someone, well, they disappeared. But unfortunately, so did the patients.
Right. You point to a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association that shows from 2008 to 2012, the FDA approved 400 implanted devices of moderate to high risk without any clinical testing. Do we read that right?
Exactly. In fact, the overwhelming majority of medical devices that are on the market that are implanted in patients undergo no clinical trials. So of the very high-risk devices capable of causing serious injury or death, those devices, only 5% even underwent 2 clinical trials. And even those clinical trials weren't necessarily trustworthy.
How did this happen? Like, what's the overarching thing here? Yeah.
What happened was, is medical devices didn't come under the purview of FDA until 1976. And at that point, there were lots of devices already on the market, things like pacemakers, artificial hips. And so what the FDA did once devices came under their regulation was they said, okay, all you guys that are already out on the market, you can stay on the market. But we're going to divide you up into 3 classes. Class 1 devices are low risk, class 2 intermediate risk, and class 3 are the high risk implanted devices. So with the class 3 devices, companies were able to keep putting new versions on the market simply by tweaking them and saying, well, there's already a device on the market like this, so we're just going to add a supplement. Mm. Well, the original device was never put through clinical trials in the first place.
Right. Well, this brings us to Dennis Fagan, who had a VNS, or vagus nerve stimulator, implant in his neck. This was to regulate seizures. It worked for a while, and then the seizures came back even worse. It led to one horrendous night. But just briefly, what does the vagus nerve do? What did this thing do? And then what happened to him?
Well, nobody knows why stimulating the vagus nerve should control seizures. And in fact, there's really no evidence that it really does. What happened to Dennis was one night he was awakened by a pain in his throat, and he thought that that meant a seizure. He knew from prior experience that he'd have this pain in his throat with a seizure. So he got up and he put a vertical mark on his calendar on that date. And when his parents found him the next morning, there were 12 marks on that date. And they came into his house, and he stumbled out of his room and fell face first onto the floor. And then, afraid of falling again, he wiggles over, props himself up against a wall with his back to the wall. His legs are splayed in front of him. His jeans are wet with urine, and he promptly passes out again. When the paramedics come, they give him some medicine for epilepsy, and it doesn't work. So they rush him to the hospital, where the ER doctor looks at his seizures and gives him more, and it still doesn't work. And that's when his doctor notices that Fagan's heart is stopping at exactly 3-minute intervals. Fagan wasn't passing out from seizures. He was passing out from lack of oxygen to the brain. The cardiologist takes a look at this, and they're all puzzled. And in comes the neurologist, who finally explains that Fagan had this VNS device put in him, and the device is set to fire at exactly 3-minute intervals.
So it was the device that was meant to save him that was actually, you know, maybe it had stopped at one point the seizures, but now it was stopping his heart. And then you have this scene where everybody's running around trying to find the thing that you turn this off with. It's a magnet.
When they realize it's the device, he finally gets the doctor rushes off, gets the thing to turn it off. And when he turns it off, the seizures completely stop.
Yeah.
So it's clear that the device, instead of stopping his seizures, was stopping his heart. And despite that, the company tried to blame a medicine that Fagan was taking. But there's another way they get off the hook, and that's with the Supreme Court preemption ruling that says that you can't sue the device maker. And the rationale is, oh, the FDA has tested it so well that we can't sue them because they've been approved. Now, that's a real change. And that's part of regulatory capture, that the FDA hired somebody from the tobacco companies, the legal firm that defended tobacco companies and drug companies, Dan Troy, and he filed an amicus brief on behalf of the FDA so that people couldn't sue. And the FDA had previously always supported the right of people to sue, saying it's the only way to keep people safe so that we learn about these problems.
Well, meanwhile, Dennis Fagan tries to warn the company, the FDA. Nobody will listen to him. He finds VNS message boards on the internet where people are having this conversation. He finds databases that shows that people are dying. Meantime, we're learning some of the other problems here. Doctors have no way of even knowing if you have an implant. So when he was rushed to the hospital near death, they didn't know he had a device. I mean, that is so frightening.
Yes. It is. And unfortunately, a program to have device identifiers on all implanted devices has been in the works for over a decade, and it just hasn't happened.
He tries to get documents from the FDA using the Freedom of Information request. You say it's like a Kafka novel where he can't get the information. But where are we on medical devices? I mean, your book obviously has been explosive. But is there a sense that this might change, or is it just about educating people so that they know?
No, things are getting worse now. With the 21st Century Cures Act that was passed in 2016, they allowed the level of evidence that's used to approve devices to degrade even further. One of the problems with the device in Dennis Fagan is that that device was known to cause a high rate of deaths. And that's a direct quote from the FDA's own transcripts when they were considering the device, a high rate of deaths among the people who were implanted. They only approved the device conditionally, but they didn't require the manufacturer to tell patients that. Now, can you imagine if the company had to say to patients they were intending to implant this device in, gee, you know, the FDA has approved this only conditionally, meaning they can pull it off the market if we don't prove it's safe. Because a lot of people died. Would you still like to have this device implanted in you? Patients weren't told that.
Right.
And what I want to see is honesty in this reporting. It's not that I think all devices are bad. In fact, I'm the beneficiary of an implanted device. What's troubling is we can't tell the difference between good devices and deadly devices. Even people like The doctor you mentioned who had a hip implant, who was an orthopedic surgeon, couldn't tell a good device from a bad device because there isn't testing. The FDA simply isn't requiring that testing.
Yeah. Well, you suggest, first of all, a wall between device companies and physicians who use the devices, and a single-payer insurance system.
Well, first of all, the no payments to individual doctors. There are doctors who've made tens of thousands of dollars, some upwards of $500,000, from device companies for implanting these devices. Now, it's hidden under phrases like consulting fees or teaching fees. That's like a judge taking money from a defense attorney.
Well, what about the single-payer system? How would that change things?
Well, right now, doctors who implant devices in particular are often paid on fee-for-service, which means that every time they implant something, they make more money. So if doctors are salaried, it takes away that incentive to do more for doing more. And we don't have independent research. That's the other arm of my discussion, is that medical research has been so corrupted by allowing each manufacturer to do all the research and to tell us which device is the safest. I mean, that's rather like allowing Toyota to tell us which is the best car on the road. The FDA has been bought by these companies.
Well, so meanwhile, how is Dennis Fagan? Drove everyone crazy with his family, 15 emails a day, trying to get across what was happening. One of the wires that's supposed to be hooked up to the nerve from his VNS device
right.
has moved into his jugular vein, you know, a dangerous situation. How is he?
He's having a difficult time, but he's also persisting in his very lonely work of trying to get this device off the market or to get somebody to pay attention to the harm so that at least patients are warned about these possibilities.
That's Jeannie Lenzer. Her book that features Dennis Fagan and a host of others is called The Danger Within Us. It's about the largely unregulated world of medical devices. Jeannie, thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Robin Young, co-host with Jeremy Hobson of Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. We cover the day's most essential news with analysis and context so you know the why and the what's next, plus authors, artists, people making a difference. It's a fast-paced snapshot of the world every day. Listen to Here and Now on NPR One or wherever you listen to podcasts.
With the stock market surging, we've got some news related to one of the world's most famous investors. And yeah, we're talking about Warren Buffett. His company, Berkshire Hathaway, is currently number two on the Fortune 500. The price of just one share of stock in the company? More than $300,000. Now, there's been long speculation about who will replace Buffett when he retires, because after all, Warren Buffett is 87 years old. We've got some information on that front. Maggie Lake, hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake, and she joins us now. Hi there, Maggie.
Hi there.
So I'm seeing here that there are two men who folks believe are most likely to take over the company. What's the news there?
Yeah, that's right. And listen, these are big shoes to fill,
yeah.
But Gregory Abel, 55, is now officially vice chair of non-insurance operations. He was running Berkshire Hathaway's energy company. And Ajit Jain, 66, is the new vice chair of insurance operations. They're both longtime Berkshire veterans, both very well liked by Buffett, who's spoken very highly about them over the years. It's interesting that he's appointed them both, though. It doesn't really solve a mystery.
Yeah.
A few years back, he said that they know who his successor is, and it's a one-person job. Some think that Greg Abel has an edge because he is a little bit younger. But it may be that Buffett is just kind of hedging in his bets. God forbid something would happen to one of them. He doesn't want there to be a power struggle. But for now, they've narrowed it to two, but they're keeping the public in the dark as to who is the actual front runner.
It's like having an heir and a spare. I mean,
yes, exactly.
But just to be clear, Buffett himself hasn't announced any plans to retire.
No, that's right. He's 87. Charlie Munger's partner is in his 90s, but they're both in good health. Despite the fact they like Pepsi, they don't have any plans to retire. But a lot of people wanted a little bit more clarity on this front. And remember, I mean, Berkshire is a very vast empire, very big. But not only that, he himself is really an American icon. He's the Oracle of Omaha. He's who we turn to, you know, in times of crisis for that sort of sage, homey advice about what to do. He is this sort of larger life character. I think he recognizes and he understands people want him to lay out what the company's going to do about this.
Oh, interesting. And just as a side note, don't. I remember he was also, or Warren Buffett was also very opposed to undoing the estate tax, and yet that's happened. Has he made any comments about that?
Yeah, you know, he's commented a lot. He's powerful enough and stands on his own that he's not afraid to sort of talk to power, to say you're wrong. He's long advocated for more taxes on the rich. He also weighs in on speculative. He's not always been a big fan of tech, even though he has some investments. He just spoke out about Bitcoin. He said he thinks it's going to end a disaster. So he is that kind of, you know, person who is, he's really a traditionalist. He believes in making money the old-fashioned way, of really understanding stocks. And so, you know, that's why people call him the Oracle. It's interesting, these two men, they're going to take over the empire, but I think it's pretty clear that no one is going to be able to fill that role that he does, driving around his old Oldsmobile holding court in Omaha, Nebraska, for all those people who venture there every year.
So we got about 30 seconds here. I mean, just tell us, what is at stake for Berkshire Hathaway when this transition does eventually happen?
Well, it's hard. I mean, he really has been the company. Can they keep up that kind of performance? Is it really a formula they have? Or is this just Warren Buffett's gut, him and Charlie Munger just knowing what bets to make? I think that's unknown. And that's what's going to fall to these two gentlemen, as well as his son, who's going to be chairman, to try to replicate that sort of success and maybe a once-in-a-lifetime situation. I'm sure his investors are hoping they can do it, though.
Absolutely. Well, Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Always great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Any day now, the world's top big wave surfers will descend on Half Moon Bay in Northern California, one of the most dangerous big wave spots in the world. They'll compete in the famous Mavericks Challenge, and for the first time, women will compete. They almost did last year. That contest was canceled because of financial problems. This year, there's new management, the World Surf League, and six women who will paddle the half mile out, including Bianca Valenti, co-founder of the Committee for Equity in Women's Surfing, which waged this fight to catch these big waves. Bianca, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, listen, I'm such a fan of the sport. And how are you feeling? What's the anticipation of this? I guess they tell you when the waves are ready, but what's the anticipation?
Yeah, I'm so really excited right now. We see a couple of huge storms starting to develop in the Northern Hemisphere. So could be happening if all the conditions hold together. It could be happening in the next couple of weeks. Yeah.
You're just ready to go. Well, tell us more about this spot. First of all, you know, people might be surprised to hear this. They think Australia or Hawaii for these huge wave spots. Tell us more about this spot.
Yeah. So Mavericks has often been called the Mount Everest of big waves. Just south of San Francisco, 20 minutes south, you can get waves that start at 15 feet and go anywhere up to 100 has been recorded before. So it's a pretty phenomenal expression of energy and what's possible in nature.
And pretty dangerous. It's rock-laden at the bottom. There's, what's it called, the boneyards?
It's got a big rock reef. It's a three-tiered reef, and it goes for like about 50 yards on each section. Mm-hmm. It's pretty deep. It's like 35 feet deep. But when you wipe out, this water is really, really thick and heavy. And it can send you straight down to the bottom.
Right. And your death, you know, the Hawaiian champion, Mark Fu, drowned. You know, he got trapped in those rocks, right? In 1994.
Yeah, no, I mean, surfing Mavericks is no joke. Everyone who surfs out there puts in a lot of work, and we're all watching out for each other. But my philosophy is safety first, last, and always.
Talk a little bit about the evolution here and how women became involved, because you're talking to someone, we used to be so in love with the surfers at Gilgo Beach and Ditch Plains on Long Island, but that meant that you watched them. You didn't, you know, women didn't surf back then, and it's been a hard fight to get into the big waves. The Titans of Mavericks was the first name for this competition. It was called Men Who Ride Mountains, Men Who Ride Mountains.
Yeah, so it's been a long road to get into the event, and it's really exciting because now we're in, and so I feel like the past is the past, and it's time to move forward and just be excited to see women finally have the opportunity to compete here. And Surfing Mavericks is all about exploring what's possible. And we first saw that in 1975 when Jeff Clark paddled out there and didn't know if it was possible. And so I think the world's really going to enjoy watching women finally have the chance.
Well, I know you don't want to look too much in the rearview mirror, but it is fascinating. You and other women started surfing before and after the competitions to demonstrate that you could. What was the thinking? Were they being patriarchal and protectionist? Were they worried that women might get hurt? You know, just paddling out there is strenuous.
Yeah. You know, I'd say all of the above. And it was a long fight, and so along that way, we created the Committee for Equity in Women's Surfing. because in California we have rights on the coastline, and the coastal doctrine provides equal access to the coastline. So if you close it down for a day, you are effectively excluding women. So we use that as leverage to get into the event.
Well, and you had people on your side, including Sabrina Brennan, who was part of a local government harbor commission and who had that reasoning. You can't exclude people from the coast. Talk about another thing that propelled you into this activist mode of, you know, organizing. This notion of female surfers as, you know, these beautiful skinny blondes that would pretty much sell boards and equipment, not the super athletes that you guys are.
Yeah, so that's been one of the really challenging battles that we women surfers have faced for a really long time in our sport. And it's so awesome now to have media coverage from stations like NPR or the New York Times, LA Times. All of these major mainstream media sources are giving us media coverage for our skill. And so I think it's awesome we're starting to see the tides change.
There was that 2017 documentary, It Ain't Pretty, showing that, as the BBC put it, surfers like yourself in these freezing waters, full wetsuits, hoods, bodies strong and muscular, faces raw from the cold, noses streaming with snot. I mean, you're out there.
It's cold. It's uncomfortable. It's dark and it's scary.
My worst wipeout was at Ocean Beach.
I almost died.
I knocked in my two front teeth.
There's like blood like all around me.
These girls are charging. There's consequences out there in big wave surf, and that story needs to be shared.
So talk about what it's like. These waves, 100 feet high. What do you do differently when it's a 100-foot wave?
I haven't caught a 100-foot wave ever,
okay.
So
when
I
it's
don't know.
60, what is the biggest?
I've gotten a 40-footer before.
Oh, so what do you do differently?
I mean, breath work is huge. Just being able to stay calm and focused and take action. It's like in any high-risk situation, you can either, you know, run and hide, or you can take action and fully commit. That I have like a bunch of little mantras, and one of my favorite ones is dedicate, don't hesitate.
Is it true that you practice holding your breath for 4 minutes?
Yes, it is true. And in fact, I bet you could do it too with the proper coaching. It's really amazing to actually explore that and use a professional diving coach, because the human body can learn how to do it in a day.
Wow. Well, and you need that. You know, what happened the first time you caught a really big wave?
Oh, God. The first time I caught a really big wave, I almost died. It was at Ocean Beach. I didn't even catch a wave, actually. I was with a friend. We didn't really know how big the waves get at Ocean Beach in San Francisco. We paddled out, made it out pretty easily, and then there was about a 15-foot wave just about to break in the worst possible spot, and I dove under it, and I was spinning every which way underwater, had no idea which way was up, opened my eyes, it was all black. Mm. And then my feet touched the ground, and I barely had enough energy to slowly swim to the top. I did like 2 or 3 strokes, and I thought right before I got to the surface, I just thought, you know, if there's another wave, I'm going to die. Mm. And I got to the surface. And luckily, there was not another wave, obviously, because I'm still here. Mm-hmm. And my whole body was convulsing. I was gasping for air. And once we got there on the sand, I just looked at those waves and I thought that I want to surf out there and I know I can do it, and that I have to start really working hard and putting in all the work that it takes. And I think it's really about psychological safety and just making yourself feel really comfortable in really uncomfortable situations.
Hmm. And what is it like when you catch it?
And then, so that's the fun part. It's like you're going a million miles an hour and everything is kind of standing still at the same time. So it's really, really fast, but at the same time, it's really slow. And all your senses, everything is just heightened in. There's no other place you are except for right there in the moment. Mm-hmm. And it's what people often are seeking to experience through meditation.
Is it like an elevator drop?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, like it's like a roller coaster ride, and you're just mostly airdropping when it's that big, when it's 40 feet. And then you hope that right when you land on the surface of the water, you smoothly land and gain speed. But if you are just slightly off in your body positioning, you could catch a rail, and then you've got a mountain of water coming down on you, and you're going to get sent down really deep really quickly.
Well, and you've said that those wipeouts are actually positive. You make them positive.
Yeah, I mean, every failure is an opportunity to learn, and that goes for any sport or any business person, student, anything. You know, failure is the opportunity and how you learn to get to being the best you can be.
Well, also, you say it's like the power of the universe. It's like the awesomeness.
Yeah, that's what I most love about Mavericks. And in the very first time I went out there, I just thought it was so magical and so special because you're sitting out there half a mile off the shore, the water's freezing, and, you know, you're right near this major city, but for some reason it feels like you could be the only person in the world on the water out there, and just out of nowhere come these huge mountains of water, and when they show up, there's enough energy to light up all of San Francisco. So it's like this moment where you're just like, whoa, I didn't even know something like this existed. It's awesome. So yeah, I'm really excited for the women, all of us, to get to compete at Mavericks this year, and everyone, I hope everyone tunes in because it's going to be amazing.
That's Bianca Valenti. She's one of the women who ride mountains. Bianca, best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
The window for officials okaying the Mavericks competition closes February 28th. We will be watching.
The USS Navy destroyer Carney arrived in Ukrainian waters this week as part of ongoing American efforts to support the Ukrainian government. The Ukrainian military is fighting Russian-backed rebels in the eastern part of the country, a conflict that began in 2014 and has claimed more than 10,000 lives. The war in eastern Ukraine broke out after Russia annexed Crimea away from Ukraine, and that annexation after a revolution that toppled the Russian-backed president of Ukraine. The BBC's Jonah Fisher joins us from Kiev. And Jonah, before we talk about U.S. involvement in this conflict, first of all, just bring us up to speed. What is going on in eastern Ukraine right now?
I think the most accurate description for it is a simmering conflict. The front line between the Ukrainian government forces and the Russian-backed rebel forces really hasn't moved substantially over the last few years. What we have basically is both sides shelling each other. We have little escalations which take place. We have casualties of perhaps a handful every few days. It's still a conflict which is being fought on the ground, but it's not a conflict really that either side seems to think it can win. It's not a stalemate, but a simmering conflict which goes in cycles of rising tensions and periods of relative calm without ever really threatening a decisive breakthrough from either side.
Now, in December, the Trump administration announced that it would be sending lethal aid to Ukraine to support that fighting in the eastern part of the country. Is that something that Ukraine had requested? And what's been Russia's response?
Yeah, Ukraine had wanted this for a long time. They believe that they should be getting more support from the Western world in particular. They've been calling for quite a long time for the US in particular to